Hi, this is Danielle from The Jealous Curator, and this is episode 108 of Art for Your Ear. Thankfully, continually sponsored by the lovely people at Saatchi Art. They are the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. You can view all sorts of gorgeous work at SaatchiArt.com. Oh, and while I'm at it, pop over and check out limited.saatchiart.com. Yes, they have just launched this site filled with, you guessed it, limited edition prints, which I think is a really great way to build out your collection without breaking the bank. So, you know, they're a little bit more special than regular prints, but less expensive than originals. Anyway, go check it out, limited.saatchiart.com. Okay, so in the summer, I put up an Instagram post asking you guys if there's anyone you'd like me to have on the podcast. There was an overwhelming number of you who said, Heather Day, Heather Day, Heather Day. Well, I heard you loud and clear, and luckily for all of us, Heather Day said yes. I am going to ask her all about pouring cans of paint and buckets of water on canvas. Ready? Calling Heather in San Francisco. Hi, Heather.
Hey, Danielle. How's it going?
Good. I'm so happy to talk to you because, do you know why? When I put out to my listeners that I was coming back with season two, I don't know if you saw this, but I put it out on Instagram and said, who do you guys want me to talk to? I think I got like 50 Heather Days.
Really? That's so flattering.
Yeah,
I didn't see that.
Yeah, people were like, Heather Day, Heather Day, Heather. And I was like, okay. I'm emailing her right now. And I'm so glad that you said yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I've been a longtime follower of the work that you share. I'm a big fan.
Oh, good. Yay. Well, this is perfect because I wanted to do a big post about you, but it's so much more fun if I can do a big post about you that goes along with a podcast episode.
One-on-one is best.
Yeah, then get behind the scenes. Because I have to say, I love when you go to your website, that video at the beginning. I was like, I could just watch that thing on repeat.
Yeah, it's pretty mesmerizing. Vanessa shot that and she's just incredible to work with.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah, and you can just see how physical it is. Anyway, we're going to get to that. But anyway, so here we are talking. I'll put the link to your site in the post so people can see the video. Okay, so this is what I always do. I want to know if you were an art kid when you were little and were you throwing paint on things then?
Yeah, completely. I was a pretty weird kid growing up. I was more of a tomboy. I was really into skateboarding and surfing. I spent my summers in Hawaii with my dad. That's where he lives, and a lot of time on the East Coast as well. But I traveled a lot as a kid. And since I was spending my summers in Hawaii, I think that's when I really was able to dive into, I guess, figuring out what my creative process was. And you know, at the time, I would say like maybe age 10, I was really into, you know, making weird robots out of cereal boxes and just any kind of cardboard and scotch tape. And I kind of envy that now because I think I thought I was better at thinking three-dimensionally then. And now I'm trying to get back into that.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, completely. I would love to figure out how to make painting just more of a personal three-dimensional experience.
Wow, that's so cool. Well, eat more cereal. Then you'll have the boxes and you'll be ready to go.
I need a lot more boxes.
And so let's talk about Hawaii. Oh, I love Hawaii. So do you think, because when I read that about you, I thought, oh, it's so interesting because your colors that you use now, do you think there's any connection to sort of growing up in Hawaii part-time? Or not really?
Yeah, I think there is. I was born there and moved quite a bit as a kid. But as I was saying, I would go back every summer. And so I kind of always had that kind of like history of color following me everywhere I went. It definitely resurfaced when after college, I guess, when I moved to San Francisco. But even all through, all through college, like those colors would appear. And I started feeling kind of self-conscious about how often I was using the color blue. And then I got to a point where I was like, okay, well, if I'm so obsessed with blue, I'm going to learn everything there is to know about it and really understand kind of the pigment and the history behind it and dive back into it. So that's where I am now.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, like why not embrace it if that's your thing? And you know. And so, what did you learn? Yeah. What are you learning about it?
Well, I'm learning kind of. I think blue has taught me a lot about other colors, actually. So I'm learning like why certain colors are harder to paint with, and why blue is so easy. Blue is kind of such a natural color for us to go to. It's soothing for us. It represents the ocean and kind of a natural state, and it's easy on the eyes. And then, you know, if you think about the color red and what that signifies, oftentimes it's very alarming. It can mean warning signs or blood or you know, a stop sign. Granted, this depends on the culture. But I started thinking about like what these colors represent to other cultures and also what they mean for me in my paintings. And then the more I dove into thinking about blue and comparing it to other colors, I started thinking about how blue is kind of my general composition, and then other color like red and pink are kind of like punctuation or a means to draw the eye around the canvas.
Mm-hmm. Totally. You know what? It's so funny. I'm having this weird little flash that this summer, because I use a lot of the same colors over and over and over, and I was thinking the same thing as you. You know, it was like, oh, is this a crutch? You know, why am I using these things? So I'm a bit of a list maker. So I actually made a list of all the colors that I use over and over and what each color, you know, like those word association games where it's like blue and then you have to say, you know, what it means.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. Yeah. Like they all instantly had a meaning for me. And it's just made working a lot easier because I kind of have not only my instincts, but almost like a visual vocabulary. Like I have a bit of a plan.
Yeah, and what are your tendencies with color?
Well, I have this thing about pink, any shade of pink, and then a lot of electric blues. And then I like huge chunks of black, but it's usually when things aren't going particularly well.
Okay, and, so yeah. Maybe to block things in.
Yeah, I think so. And the pink thing, I didn't really realize, but when my grandmother was dying, she had said, you know, sort of in and out of consciousness, and she kind of came very clearly through one day and said, my spirit is pink. And we were all like, okay, you know, because she hadn't really been conscious very much, you know, in the past few weeks. And so we sort of said, you know, calm down. And she was like, no, you have to hear me. My spirit is pink. And we were like, okay. And then she died, I think, a day or two later. And then after that, my whole family, like, we see so many weird pink things happen. And this was 17 years ago that she died. And so I've only started making again recently, but pink just kept coming up. And I was never even really thinking about it until I thought about it. And so now instead of, because I was worried like, oh, I don't want people to think I'm being girly or, you know, ooh, Barbie or whatever. And then when I kind of realized this is why pink comes up, it's allowed me to really embrace it and be proud of it and not worry about what other people think because I know why I'm doing it.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think pink is such a fascinating color, especially in my work recently. I've been diving into it, and it's such kind of like a confident, curious color, I would say. Like mm-hmm. Any range on the spectrum, it can either be like sassy or beautiful or light toned, and it really has a lot of range compared to other colors. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when you change red, it suddenly shifts to pink or orange, but pink has like, I don't know, I feel like it has more flexibility in what it represents. But it actually was a color I avoided up until a couple years ago because I realized I wasn't doing it on purpose, I suppose, but there was kind of this stigma for me on what pink represented. And I realized, you know, none of my all my favorite painters were male painters, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I really had to dive back into art history and look for the women. And I realized that I was avoiding pink because I didn't want people to associate femininity with my work. I wanted it to kind of have that strong masculine feel when they look at it and not have gender be a problem or, mm-hmm. you know, not a problem, but I didn't want gender to be.
To even
relevant.
Come up. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is, yeah. This is, oh, I mean, we're what, 5 minutes in, this is so interesting. I'm writing a new book right now all about women artists because I found it so frustrating in art school that they didn't tell us about any female artists. Yeah. And being a woman artist, I was like, well, I want to know who came before me. Like, how am I supposed to, you know, I just didn't feel like I had a knowledge base to understand the past and the present so that I could then be the future. And yeah, you kind of do have to dig back in yourself. I'm hoping that this book becomes like the handbook.
I think that's so important. You got to find your people.
Yeah.
And so as a female painter, it's a little disheartening when it's, you really have to look.
I know,
for such
right?
Great talent.
I know. Yeah. And there is so much talent. It was just, I remember asking my profs, like, surely there were women painting too. And they were like, oh yeah, you know, of course there was, but they just weren't documented unless they were the muse of somebody else. And I was just like, oh, it just makes me so mad.
Yeah, don't get me started.
No, don't get me started. I know, but then, funny, you know, I had the exact same thing about pink. Like, I was so worried, you know, when I was at art school that, because it was very male-dominated, and I was very worried that, like, because when I did use pink, it was like, oh, you know, you're just saying that women are this and that. And I'm like, no, I just like that color. So I abandoned it for a really long time, and it wasn't until, you know, probably 10 years after my grandmother passed that I just started using it constantly, almost unapologetically, and it kind of took a moment for me to piece it together to realize why I was doing it. But, you know, as a designer, I was a graphic designer for years and years and years, and I always told, you know, students if I taught that if you choose a color, have a reason why, you know, don't be like, I don't know, I just like pink. Like, there needs to be a reason for what you're choosing and what you're doing so that there's purpose and intent behind what you're doing. And for some reason, I never had that in my artwork, and now I do. And it's just so interesting that obviously you do too.
Yeah, the only thing I would like to say with that is just that if you choose a color, I'm not sure you need to have a reason why right away. I think it's important to, because I think almost it can make me pause in the studio if I'm just overthinking everything.
Yeah.
But it's great to reflect and be like, oh, that's why I did that. And then, you know, use it intentionally another time.
Yeah,
I think it's good
totally.
To kind of have that give and take.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for saying that, because you're totally right. But the reflecting thing is so, it's so important, and it leads to your next piece and your next body of work, and it evolves your whole practice, really.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk. Okay, so wait a minute. I'm getting all carried away here. So we've talked about me a lot. Sorry about that. So you're a kid, you're surfing, you're sticking tape onto cereal boxes. And so did you kind of always just know that you would go to art school?
You know, it's such a strange thing to think about now, because art was kind of always there for me. It was the thing that I could get, because there was no right or wrong answer. I'm dyslexic, and I struggled in school as I got older, because I started realizing, I don't even know if I would say I was struggling in school because it wasn't being taught in the way I thought, the way I was understanding math or whatever class I was in. And so art was something, it was kind of always my escape, where I knew it wasn't so concrete. It was something I could go do on my own and have that me time away from everything else that was so serious.
Yeah. And yeah, you're right. No right or wrong. You could approach it any way you wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. So I moved a ton as a kid. So it's a little confusing, because I bounced around. My mom was a Marine. And so I went from, actually I lived in Hawaii and then Japan, and then mostly around the East Coast quite a bit around Washington, D.C. And then I had the great privilege of moving in with my grandparents when I was in high school, and I went to an arts high school in Chicago.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was living out in the suburbs of D.C., like Arlington, Virginia, and then I moved to Chicago and suddenly was in what seemed like such a, you know, it's a big city, and it was such a kind of culture shock. And I was looking for a school, and I was there right before the school year was starting, right before my freshman year. And the school system in Chicago is pretty rough, and it's kind of like applying to college, really. It's hard to find a school to go to so last minute. But one place I went to had recommended this art school called the Chicago Academy for the Arts, and end up going there, and it really saved me, because I suddenly had 3 hours of art a day. And I was surrounded by like-minded people, everything from the teachers to the students that were there to get their academics in and also focus on their arts in the afternoon.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was a really special experience. And I was so worried going into it, I was really into soccer, and I also played competitive soccer all through high school, and but I didn't do that through my high school. And I was worried that I wasn't going to have time for things like that, or that I was already kind of majoring. It was like picking a major in college, basically.
Right, as a freshman.
Fine art. Yeah, but it ended up being exactly what I needed.
Wow, that's so cool. As you're saying that, it just like made my shoulders drop for you. Just like, oh, there we go.
it was a huge relief because, you know, I would have a history teacher that could then explain the Great Depression and in ways where he would talk about how the arts influenced it. And suddenly, you know, my ears would perk up and I'd be listening, you know. And so it was little things like that that really went a long way with me and helped me get into going to an arts college as well.
Yeah, I guess so. That's so funny. When I was in university, I had to take, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I wanted to keep my options open in case I wanted to be a teacher. And so one of the things I had to take was a Canadian history course, and it was so boring, so boring. And it was at 8 a.m. on Friday morning, and pub night was Thursday night. So it was very difficult. It's a very difficult time. Yeah. And so I signed up for a Canadian art history class at the same time, because I was so interested in that. And they started basically at the same timeline. So as, you know, they're talking about war and stuff in the history class, you're learning about the artists that were doing wartime paintings. And I got an A in the history class because the only way I could pay attention was because I was like, oh, wait a minute, that must have been this year because that artist painted this in this year. And otherwise, I wouldn't have not cared at all.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to make those connections with something you actually care about more.
Yeah, and that's so nice that you could do it in high school. And so then where did you go to go to college?
I went to the Maryland Institute College of Art. We call it MICA also, mm-hmm. which is, it's a fairly big art school, but in terms of colleges, it's very small. But yeah. That's in Baltimore, Maryland.
And so did you live in Res, or was your mom back there, or no?
My mom, she was living, my mom's been in and out of living in Afghanistan, but I think she was around Washington, D.C. at the time. I think she was in D.C., so I was in close proximity to some family there, and I was able to just to dive into the art school lifestyle, and I actually went to MICA for environmental design because my senior year of high school I was really diving into architecture and I was just super curious about it. But I think I was also very curious about how to make like a practical living,
right?
as a creative person, and even though you know architecture is also a challenge. But after my freshman year, I then switched to painting, art history, and curatorial studies.
Oh, nice. That is so funny, architecture, because your work is so loose. Like,
yeah.
That's so...
It's crazy because I'm still kind of a wannabe architect, I would say. Like, I think it's such a, to me, it seems like such a dreamy job. I'm sure architects listening to this would probably laugh, but, and I'm working with an architecture firm right now, and it just seems like such an amazing project because I'm just so in awe of them. But we work very differently, but I guess what I'm really fascinated by is how we interact with space, negative and positive, and how things flow. And that's how, I guess maybe it's a stretch, but that's how my work relates to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess that's why you're sort of more interested in the whole idea of being more three-dimensional in whatever that means to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Opposites attract.
What does that mean to you? I'm so curious. Like, does that mean painting the way your process, the way that you paint, or does that mean painting in a mural type way where you're surrounded by the work, or does that mean actually putting 3D objects into the painting?
You mean to get somebody kind of, I guess what I mean is that somebody could walk into a room and suddenly find themselves immersed in a painting. Yeah. So I recently worked, this could, I guess I'm hesitant to talk about it because there's so many ways that it can happen and I'm still figuring it out.
But, oh, okay. Then let's
I think it's interesting to talk through the process. So bear with me for a second.
Okay.
But, I just worked with Facebook on augmented reality mural on the Facebook campus.
Oh.
And I collaborated with their applied machine learning team. It was actually with Mark Zuckerberg's team. And so they contacted me. We only had 2 weeks. And they called me and then they asked me to come in the next day. And then we worked for 2 weeks straight. And it was an incredible process because the designer, Kristen Spielman, there had seen my mural that I did in Oakland. And the mural was basically the paint wrapped from the mirror, from the wall to the sidewalk to the curb. So the idea is that you're walking down the street and you're really part of that mural rather than there being a separation. But I feel that that is just the beginning. And so Facebook contacted me after seeing that mural and they basically told me all my dreams could come true at that point. You know,
so you said, I'll be there tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, I honestly still had no idea what it was. And so I went in there and it was a room full of really talented designers. And we just basically talked about our imagination. And I said, you know, imagine like if you're walking down the street and, you know, you see the color on the fire hydrant. And if you could just take that color and spread it onto the sidewalk and then it splashes in the air into the street when a car drives by. And there's kind of an interaction with paint movement and color and it's just kind of going everywhere. And they're like, that's great. We can make that with augmented reality. And so we spent time working and painting in my studio and then working with animators to figure out how to make that appear in space using the Facebook camera.
Oh, my God. When was, so is it like, is there anywhere you can see this yet or are they, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's up. It's at the Facebook campus right now. So it's like, at their newest building where Mark Zuckerberg's office is just outside those doors.
Yeah.
And there's a video, circulating on Facebook and on my website as well. But, the idea is that you walk up to the space and you see an empty wall and there's a plaque that says, you know, mural by Heather Day. And you're like, where is it? And then you take out your Facebook camera app and you face the camera towards the wall and suddenly the wall comes to life where there's paint coming out from beneath your feet and splashing onto the wall and then coming off like a waterfall.
Oh my gosh. That is so cool. I have to say, you know, Facebook, love them or hate them, they have their choice of art and artists that they work with is insane.
Yeah,
like
they
campus,
really have something going.
Yeah, they really do. Like, somebody from there reached out to me because it. So many of the people that they have had do installations and things there, I've written about, and they didn't know that I did it, and vice versa. It's just like, but everybody, I got to go down there. I've never been there, but I have to go and see it because I think I would just be in awe of every corner.
Yeah, I'd be happy to go with you if you come to town.
Okay, there you go. It's a date.
Yeah, yeah, totally. But it was so funny. There was a funny moment when we were early three or four days in the project, but we were moving so fast. It was like we were 3 months into the project. And I just told somebody candidly on the site, I was like, you know, I have no idea what I'm doing. All this technology is so new that I literally, it's like you just gave me a paintbrush for the first time. And then she kind of laughed and was like, you know, none of us do. We all just learned this technology, you know, this month. So you're with us.
That was going to be my next question. Like, so they call you, you go the next day. It's like, you don't even have time to mentally prepare. Were you like, what the hell am I doing here? Like, did you feel intimidated or are you like, yes, let's make some dreams come true?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's so much imposter syndrome, right?
Yeah.
The idea that you fake it till you make it. But I, you know, I went there pretty excited about what they told me on the phone and I had already, the weirdest part is I had already written a letter to Mark Zuckerberg about how I wanted to work with VR. And I hadn't found the right person to give the letter to get to Mark Zuckerberg. And I realize how ridiculous that sounds, but, you know, you got to shoot for the stars, right? And so I had this letter. And so I had this letter working for about a month. And then Kristen Spielman from Facebook contacted me and We were DMing on Instagram, and then we were on the phone, and then she said, "Can you come in Thursday?" I said, "Yes." And then I realized she meant tomorrow, not next Thursday. And then, 2 weeks later, Mark Zuckerberg was presenting it at the F8 conference.
So, oh my word.
Pretty incredible.
I'm slowly shaking my head as we're sitting here, because it's just like, you know, there's something so cool in writing something down, like your intention. You know, and
putting it out in the universe.
Yeah. Well, I was just taught this course in Venice in the summer, and I had everybody that was in the group write a letter to the universe to say, like, blue sky, like whatever you want. And I'm making them send it to me. Not that I'm the universe, but
I love that.
but just to make them do it, because now I'm sitting here waiting for the letters to roll in, right? Like there's some responsibility and they have to do it. And I've got a few so far, and they're just so powerful and amazing. And I'm going to wait a year, and then I'm going to mail them back to them. And I bet they will be surprised by how many of the things have happened.
Yeah, I think, I think that's so important. I think writing that letter was really part of my creative process for those last 3 months before I got contacted, because I think I might have written that letter around the same time. You know, I was doing that mural in Oakland, and so I was already thinking about space three-dimensionally, and I think it also appears in my paintings, and then it comes up in conversation. So before you know it, you're actually putting yourself out there in more of a physical way, where you're interacting with people that think similarly or might have a connection. So writing your intentions down, I think, is kind of just the start for how you can connect with other people, whether it's through your work or in person.
Mm-hmm. And, I think that comes, the whole idea of doing you, and not trying to do things other people are doing, or do things that you think people want you to do. I think just doing the things you want leads to the things you want. I saw this guy speak, and I am blanking on his name. This is years ago. He was a Flash developer when Flash first came out. I'm totally dating myself. People are like, "What's Flash?" Anywho, but he also was an artist, and so he was doing this stuff with programming and Flash, and then he would output it, and he was actually showing at the Pompidou, which is my dream gallery, and he was talking about doing the things you want versus just doing the things that, are put in front of you. So we were a bunch of web designers at the time. And he said, if you do a bank site and you do a really good job at it, the next people that call you are going to be another bank. And then you'll probably do a good job at that. And then another bank will call you. And if you don't want to be doing bank sites, like if you want to be doing indie music sites, fine, do the bank sites during the day so you can get a paycheck. But you need to be up until 4 a.m. doing indie music sites for free, or for, in exchange for tickets to shows or whatever, so that you become known for the thing you want to be doing. And that instantly puts you in the group of like-minded people, right?
Yeah, completely. It kind of teaches you how to get better at what you want to do if you're doing it for free, or whatever it is you're doing on the side. And then it also teaches you kind of how to interact with people and how to get those projects.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is the coolest thing. I cannot wait to look that up. And hopefully we can have a date there and go and actually see all this stuff. Okay, so let's talk about that video on the front of your site. I love how physical it is, because you can't, like, your work is beautiful when you, I mean, JPEGs are so tricky, websites and JPEGs, it's like, oh, beautiful composition, great color. Then you see you make it, and it's just like a whole other appreciation, like buckets of water, and you're on your hands and knees, and things are getting pushed and rubbed. And I want to know when you started doing that, if that was like in college or afterwards.
Yeah. So, I was kind of a scattered painter high school, college. I was really bouncing around from doing, I was obsessed with doing like self-portraits at 2 a.m. and drawing my friends. And I really loved drawing movement, drawing dancers, and drawing that negative space in between them. And I suppose that's when abstraction first started happening, was when I was observing the negative space more than the actual figure. And then in college, it was really, I was fascinated by urban decay, living in Baltimore with a lot of abandoned buildings and kind of just the urban contrast. And I started realizing that I was doing a good job at capturing those buildings. I could take a photograph or I could go see a building, draw the composition, and then go paint it. But it wasn't really personal. And so I started thinking about what those layers of paint might mean to me, and also what those layers of paint mean to the city. Just the idea that, you know, it snows and the salt hits the wall and it starts to decay, and then somebody goes and tags the wall, and then there's layers of paint on top of it, and there's this beautiful composition that forms, but still it didn't completely have anything to do with me. You know, I was living in the city and I was witnessing it happen, but I wanted to push that idea further. So I thought, how can I make my own decay or own walls, maybe in a less literal sense? And so I started, I was really diving into work by, well, I still am. I've recently gone back to them, but Helen Frankenthaler, and really fascinated by how she could pour the paint and how you could fall in love with the mark, or just a simple pour, and how that could be enough. And then how other times you can really push it further and see where it goes. And that's when I started thinking about my relationship to the process. And I loved that, you know, I can be kind of a quiet person at first. You know, I'm kind of an ambivert. I kind of walk both sides. But when I'm in the studio, I'm like completely confident and in my element. And I think things kind of stand still for a little bit for me, especially when I'm in the right flow state.
I love that. Do you listen to music, or is it just quiet in there?
Well, I listen to a lot of music. I listen to podcasts, and I am embarrassingly obsessed with Bon Iver, and I need to move on. but I also love Jessica Pratt and Joni Mitchell, and artists that can really have that range in their voice, whether it's a voice or a guitar. I love to think about how sound translates into textures and color.
Me too. I often think of songs almost sound like collages sometimes, because I do collage, and so I like to listen to music that sort of sounds like a collage, which is weird, but
I love that. I think, I don't know, it's interesting when you can start to illustrate or paint pictures of what something looks, feels, or sounds like. I've had some headaches this week, and I was telling someone today that my headache felt like if you were to draw a pie shape, it was like one slice and one on the left side. And they're like, that's so strange that you just illustrated your headache. But I was like, well, maybe if I illustrate it, I'll see it, and then it'll be gone.
Yeah, there you it's
a way of coping.
Paint it out of there. And so your canvases are big generally, right?
Yeah.
And so, okay, I always ask this question usually for abstract painters and for big canvas people. I have spent many, many years being terrified of big canvases, just for the fear that I would ruin them. You know, they're so pure and filled with hope, and I'm the one that's going to ruin it, you know? So I've always been a little bit scared. So when you pour that first paint can on there, or that water, do you have any fear, or are you excited? And then if you get further along and you're really loving it, how do you know when to, like, do you ever throw one paint can too many and you're like, oh damn?
Completely. I mean, you've got to do that. I think the way you get past that is you do an obsessive amount of it. And I mean obsessive in terms of the amount of paint you pour onto the canvas, the amount of water you pour, and also the amount of canvases you stretch. You need to make painting not seem so fragile.
Yeah, it can't be precious. That's the one thing I've learned in the last couple of years. It's just like, it can't be precious. It can't be. And so I work on paper. So now I have stacks of paper so that I just go and I go again and I go again and I go again so that I don't freak out. And I'm inching up and getting slightly bigger and slightly bigger. But yeah, when I see your work, now it feels exciting to me. That would have horrified me a couple of years ago. Now it looks really exciting. So can you ever go too far, or can you always just throw another bucket of water on and, like, do you like that organic? Like, I don't know what's happening.
Oh yeah, I definitely go too far. And I would like to tell you that I'm very mature about it when I do. you know, like, well, you know what? I'll try again next time. But I have those moments where I'm really bummed. You know, a lot of my paintings, can take months. Some of them are very fast, and that feels good too. But I can be working on a painting for months, and I'll feel like I'm inching closer and closer to its completion, and then I'll decide it needs a big wash of paint. And that can make or break it. And it can be really frustrating after months of work. I am reminded then later when I have a more successful piece that I did learn a lot from that piece, every little mark. And I think it's like sketchbook pages, or it's just in general, it's like reading a book. There's kind of a narrative between my pieces. One mark kind of leads to the next and falls onto another painting, and I'll have several going at once in the room. And
I was going to ask that. How many do you have going at a time? I'm sure it depends, but.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say because I do play with size. So I have, right now, even with my show coming up, I have a lot of completed paintings in the studio. But even with that going on, I still have probably 50 paintings in progress. So
and 50?
Yeah, but
oh my gosh.
And that's probably not counting the really small, like small random sketches I have laying around, but that's ranging in, you know, 5x7 works on paper to 22x30 on paper and canvas, and then also like 56x72. I have a lot of works that didn't make the cut and are not going in my show, and I'm still figuring out if they're, you know, if it's time to just throw in the rag with them, or if I can really push them further and see what happens.
Do you ever paint over and start again, or is there just too much layers to do that?
I do that a lot, especially when I think I've lost the painting, and sometimes it ends up being the best piece when I really have nothing to lose at this point.
Yeah.
usually it's hard, I would say, once the painting has a lot more layers on it. With the type of work I do, it's weird because it's somewhat fragile in that I like the color of the canvas and the texture of the canvas. So if enough of it is covered, I do feel like it loses that like light and airiness look to it. And honestly, I always say I want my work to have something effortless and something considered and kind of like create balance within the chaos. And when it gets really heavy, I often feel like that's loss. There are exceptions, but that does happen.
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. And it is it's such a sad moment when you know that you've gone one brush stroke too far and you can't get it back. Or, but you know what I've been doing lately with those? I just did this huge one. Well, huge for me, 22x28. That's huge for me. And, I loved one part of it and hated the rest of it. And I was so mad that I'd ruined this big, beautiful piece of paper. And so I cut it down to a 12x12, and I just took the 12x12 chunk that I really liked and was done. And I was like, oh, and it's been sitting in my studio for probably 3 months, me just hating it. And then I cut it yesterday and I was like, oh, well, that was good. What else can I cut up?
Isn't that a great moment?
It's a great moment. I felt like a genius.
Yeah. And then you need to avoid getting too confident and just cutting up all your paintings.
I put my ruler and my X-Acto away because I'm like, ooh, what else can I cut?
Yeah.
Like, no, Danielle, calm down. Just calm down. And so are you ever, I don't know, do you ever get like a strained shoulder? Like, because it looks pretty physical when you're doing the big ones. Do you ever get physically tired?
Oh yeah, in so many ways. So I travel a lot and I hike down to I would say very inconvenient spots along rivers with a large amount of supplies. So it's usually like 3 trips to get everything I need down there. And I prefer to be alone on trips like that. And so that way I usually the last trip I made was the kind of like California Oregon border. On the Smith River. And after 3 hikes down, I then took an hour long nap on the river and, you know, ate a granola bar, walked around, and then I was like, okay, I think I can paint. and so it does, it's very tolling. And, especially
wow, you actually paint on location sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty funny too. When, like I was at Lake Louise and I think, being an artist can be so, over romanticized. You know, I'll be at like, if I was at a place like Lake Louise, which can kind of be rather touristy, but I made the trip because of the color of the water.
Yeah.
And, tourists would walk by and they'd get really excited being like, oh, there's an artist. She's painting plein air. And then they'd, come up and kind of look over my shoulder and then be like, oh, okay. and keep going.
Where were your snow-capped mountains?
Yeah,
that's so funny.
They were disappointed.
That's so cool. How big are the pieces you do when you're hiking into riverbeds?
So my sweet spot, I would say, is the 22 by 30 works on paper. So I usually pack those in a portfolio and put them in my car.
Wow, so it's not a sketchbook. You're like going down there and doing like real finished work.
Yeah, but to be honest, it there's so many factors. It depends on the weather. It depends on my energy level and kind of what I feel like diving into. So I try to go on these trips without too many heavy expectations on what I'm going to come back with. So I usually travel with about 8 sketchbooks. And I do that because I'm also working with paint. So I need to leave some sketchbooks open while I switch to others because I can't switch the page. So it's really
right,
just a
right.
I'll travel with them. I'll leave, you know, one in the dashboard of the car, one in my studio, one by my bed, you know, one in my backpack. And so I always have a source to go to. And then when I go on a road trip, I bring them all with me. And I have that option if I just want to sit in the car, if it's pouring rain, and pull over off the one to paint something or just draw or write something.
Wow. How many times a year do you do this?
Well, the past few months since I've been gearing up for my show, I've been working rather large, and so that has restricted me from going very far. But to kind of debrief and take a break from the studio, I've been doing kind of day trips lately. So I'll go out towards like Santa Cruz or Sharkfin Cove, where anywhere I can get perspective. Water areas are usually my go-to, but I also love the contrast of like the desert, you know, in a couple days, and then later I'll drive to the ocean. I love to kind of change and get perspective. And I usually, if I just pick a random day and I'm like, oh, I'm just going to hit the road, and I decide while I'm driving, I'm usually likely to be driving up north because I like the cooler temperatures and the range in the landscape from the mountains to the ocean.
Well, see, now that's a romantic art thing.
I mean, don't get me wrong. It is very romantic at times.
Are you by yourself? How romantic is this? Yeah.
I'm by myself a lot. My boyfriend, who I've been with, Chase McBride, for a year, is a musician.
Oh, cool.
He also studied painting for a year. And so we both kind of think in a painterly way. And so he'll often come and he'll bring his guitar, or write some new lyrics and come along for a trip. And we'll do that. And then I also like to get out alone and go explore.
Wow, that's so nice. And then, yeah, you must come back with, like, if you don't, with whatever you make there, you also come back with all sorts of inspiration and color ideas, and that must translate into work that you do after as well.
Yeah, I like to call it, I probably overuse it. I'm just obsessed with it. I think it's so cool to say like a vocabulary of mark making, or to think about everything that we do and go see is like our own personal library.
Yeah.
You know, and whatever it is, whether we're a musician, we're collecting sounds, or a painter and we're collecting textures. And so I love to go out and think of it as like a recipe sometimes. So I'm, if the sun is setting, like when I was at the Smith River, I was painting kind of the colors I saw. And when I realized that the sun was setting faster than I could paint, I then started writing down kind of the recipe of what you would need to make those paint colors, and then the time of day. And then when I'm back in the studio, I can refer back to my notes that I made and make something new. But my goal is always to never create a formula. So a composition I make somewhere else, I try not to recreate that in the studio. And if I do, it shifts.
Yeah. I have a question. What did I wrote this down. I wanted to ask you. So when you're going into a piece, do you have a palette in mind? Do you have a plan in mind, or is it very, like, how organic is this?
Yeah, I think, I do have a palette in mind, and I think in many ways the paintings start when I'm at the art supply store, or even when I'm on my way. And I'm selecting the colors that I'm going to be using on the trip. And it's usually like images of the area that I saw on Instagram or on Google Images. And so I'm already thinking about the color that I'm going to be attracted to. But I do try to always pick out a color that I wouldn't expect as well. And when I'm on site, I'm often mixing color with paint, or I'm just using pastel where it's just direct color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's paint and pastel, right, that you use?
Yeah, I use, when I'm outside the studio, I use graphite, charcoal, pastel, paint, and ink.
Okay, what kind of paint do you use? Acrylic?
Yeah, I love to use golden acrylics. They're my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somebody else has said that in my the last person I interviewed. We're going to have to, brought to you by Golden. I use Golden too. I really like it. And I was curious because, especially when you're out there, you must want, if it was oils, it wouldn't dry fast enough for you.
Yeah, it wouldn't dry fast enough. And I try to avoid oils because I don't think it's very healthy to work with them.
Mm.
Granted, I do use spray paint in the studio, but I'm usually, I'm outside typically, or I'm wearing a mask and I have a bunch of fans going. After working mostly in oils through college, I kind of made the switch as a health decision.
Mm, that's interesting. I never even used oils because in college I lived in res and there was nowhere for me to clean my brushes. So I needed water soluble. And so I never even really played around with oil.
Oh yeah. The thing that I loved about oil is probably, the color is so lush. I feel like with acrylic, I'm always trying to strive to the color that you can get from oil with the vibrancy. But from a lazy point of view, you can leave your paints out forever.
Yes.
And they don't dry.
That's true. That is true. Yeah. Yeah, acrylic, you do not have much time.
No.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you, I sometimes do research on people and sometimes I don't. And I did a tiny little bit. And I saw this very small world kind of cool thing on your site about Subaru. So speaking of your trips everywhere, I started reading and I'm like, oh, cool, a trip. And then I was like, wait a minute, you did it in collaboration with Subaru. And it's funny because my husband works for an agency that works for Subaru Canada. And so he's always trying to work with, artists and different people to do, take Subaru on the road. And I kind of love that you do that. And I want to ask you about sponsorships and things because it's a tricky line to walk. And when did you start doing that, and how do you decide who you're going to work with and all that stuff?
Yeah, I feel like I'm walking a very fine line as a painter working with sponsors, so I'm very selective with the companies I choose to work with. Subaru, for example, they were wonderful to work with, and they're very conscious of the environment and safety and all great things in terms of community. And so it was a really great fit, especially just, adventuring, and I'm a traveler. But
did they reach out to you?
Yeah. So I've attracted companies in the past few years through social media. To be honest, having a social media following does that. I have a large audience that they want to access. And then also I share more than just my studio practice. And it's so much since I travel and I'm in the studio, there's so much lifestyle that's automatically roped in. And so that opens up the doors for sponsors to reach out if they're the right fit.
Right.
And what's so interesting about it is that it's really allowed me the freedom in the studio to experiment, especially I'm working on sculpture now and doing just really weird things in terms of painting and anything I want to do, because I have companies like Subaru that are almost like patrons of the arts.
Yeah.
It's no longer like Michelangelo getting commissioned from, for the Sistine Chapel, getting commissioned by the church to paint something that they specifically wanted. Instead, I can work with a company that aligns with my values and they can support what I do. And in trade, I'll tell my audience about them.
That is such a good way to say it. And so do you ever get, because I've been very, even just with my blog, most bloggers have ads and do sponsored posts, and I just never really have. Saatchi Art's been amazing. They sponsor the podcast and my newsletter. But other than that, I don't make money from sponsors or ads or anything. And I've always been, just the way you described it, that is such a good way to put it, because, why not?
Yeah.
Who was the first sponsor that you ever worked with? And did you think, were you nervous about, you know, that going that way?
Oh, completely. I was so nervous that I wrote an open letter on my blog.
Apologizing.
Like preemptively. Yeah. Telling people what I thought about sponsors and the potential of it, because I really had no idea. It was really kind of this like black void I was heading towards. Mm-hmm. So this is going to probably surprise you, but my first sponsor was actually, I'm pretty sure it was Banana Republic. I still kind of giggle at that campaign every time because I went into that so blind. I had no idea what I was doing. And for my first sponsor, it was an international campaign. And, after we did photo shoots, and I went as far as selecting outfits from their spring wardrobe 2.5 years ago, maybe 3 years ago now. And I was fascinated by it. And when they approached, I was like, maybe this can be a thing, you know. It doesn't really have anything to do with my art, but I can spend a week on this project and it's going to fund my practice for a long time.
Yeah.
And I wasn't selling as many paintings then either. So it was just a really big deal to be able to have that opportunity. I was a little bit surprised at the impact and scale of the campaign. And, I had friends in Paris send me a photo of a window of Banana Republic and my face was on it. So, there's a lot I've learned in the process, in looking out and reading the fine lines of these contracts and fully understanding what it means. And it wasn't anything that they did wrong. It was just, I was so new to it. I really didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was your audience's reaction to you doing them? To doing sponsored stuff.
Actually, like everyone seems to be surprisingly supportive. But my biggest concern is I think the art world tends to be kind of quiet about something like that. So they might not respond to a photo, but you don't know what they're thinking. So I am walking this fine line, and I've narrowed down what type of campaigns I'm willing to take on, especially, Banana Republic had used my name and also shared my studio practice, and we did a shoot in my studio and they shared my work as well, which really helped a lot actually. And so there was like a huge component to my lifestyle and my life as an artist. But moving forward, I'm selective of how I work with brands and who they are and how much it relates to what I do. So it's probably a little bit more, like Subaru aligned a little bit more with what I do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that is so good. And see, you can tell I'm totally curious about this because I quit my design job about a year ago.
Yeah.
To do Gels Curator full time. And, you kind of need to still pay the mortgage. But I am so, maybe it's, the Canadian in me or the fact that I'm a woman and Canadian that I'm so apologetic that it's just like, oh, I don't want to offend anybody. But that's why working with Saatchi has been so great, is because, we are so aligned.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to do a little bit more of it here and there, but I am just, I feel like I'm on a tightrope because I just don't, it's just tricky. So I really applaud you for what you're doing, and that you I think that's such a nice way to put it. It's like, if you want to keep going with your practice, like, do this for a week, make enough money that you can then go and do the work that you want to do. And, hopefully, our communities and, people in general will kind of not begrudge you that, and they shouldn't.
Yeah. I'm realizing as I was saying that, it's very hard to openly talk about, sponsors, just in terms of, the types of opportunities they bring, because on one hand, it's a really scary, like slippery slope to go down, if suddenly everything is sponsored.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if it means it supports what you do and you can do that for a while, I think go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that I read that blog post of yours, because I think it's a really important discussion, and I think people listening, I think it's going to strike a nerve with a lot of people, and it's a good conversation to have. So thank you for that. And thanks for being so open to talk about it.
Of course.
Okay, so business taken care of. Let's do the not so speedy speed round.
Okay, sounds great.
Okay, Do you know about this not so speedy speed round? It's just not very fast speed round because I ask follow up questions usually.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. I've actually listened to a few of your podcasts.
Okay. So it started out as a speed round, and I'm just not good at it. So here we go. Have you or would you ever pour nail polish onto a canvas?
You know, I might have done it in high school, but I probably would never do it again.
I don't think it's not very archival.
It's not very archival, and there's other mediums you can experiment with that will probably do a better job.
Fair enough. I'm always, I am one of those people that, you know, like the art store makes me go, ooh, and ah, but also so does the nail polish aisle.
Yeah, I mean, the colors there, they're very lush.
Yeah, they are. Okay, good to know. You might have to think about this for a second. Your favorite toy from childhood?
Well, let's see. I just thought of the creepiest toy.
Okay, let's hear that.
I think when I was like 10, I got a Furby for Christmas. And I just remember hiding it in my closet and hearing it like make noises and go off in the middle of the night. And it was just never ending. But I think I used to go down to my brother had a bedroom in the basement. And I remember I'd go downstairs and knock on his door and ask him if there was anything he didn't want. Very strange thing that me and my sister did, but he always had the best thing. So I remember he had like, I think they were called Mr. Sketch markers, and they were smelly.
I don't
know how healthy it was, but it was definitely pretty amazing to be able to sketch with something you can smell.
My son has those right now.
Oh, they're still around.
Oh, they're still around. You can go out right now and buy a pack.
Awesome. I need to do that.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, what was I going to say? Oh, did you ask for the Furby or was it just given to you?
Oh, yeah. I wanted it so badly. And so I couldn't tell my parents that it was creeping me out.
That's so funny. When my son was little, he had one of those like, it was like a shape like a barn, and like if you turned the dial to the cow, it would moo and, you know, whatever. And yeah. But as it lost battery, it would sometimes just randomly moo. But it'd be like late at night, and it was like this weird, like the battery was dying, so it would be like coming from down.
Yeah, sounds like a Furby. And yes. They would like snore and make weird noises and tell you they're hungry. And
yeah, it was terrifying. It was terrifying. Yeah. So I bought my sister one when she had her baby. I was like, enjoy.
Make sure that battery is dying.
Make sure you change the battery. Okay, Doritos or donuts?
Definitely Doritos.
Salty.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking when I wrote that, because depending on the day, I could go either way. But I was like, you know, there's bacon donuts.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So to be honest, I can't have gluten. So...
neither.
Oh, okay. So if I can get a donut that is gluten-free and is actually really good, it's really something special.
Yeah, that's right. You just hold on to that and enjoy every single morsel, because that never happens.
Completely savor it. Yeah.
Okay, let's see if you can remember this. Who did you go to prom with?
I went to prom just with my girlfriends, actually. Since my high school was so small, I went to prom every year because if just the seniors went, it wouldn't be a prom.
Right.
So I got to go every year, and it was just a big friend ordeal. It was great.
Nice. That's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Y'all just pile in the limo and show up, and there you go.
Yeah. It was pretty great. Bunch of nerdy artists.
I love it. That was it. That was all my questions.
Awesome.
That was such a cool conversation. Thank you so much for that. Like that was ins and outs of all sorts of things.
Yeah, we covered everything. It's crazy. Business and art. Who would have thought?
I know. And gluten-free donuts. It's all in there. Well, if we end up having a Facebook date, we will go and get some gluten-free donuts and work it into a, they've got to have gluten-free donuts. That sounds like something they'd have.
They probably do.
Yeah. But thank you so much for this. And I cannot wait to do a great big post on my site with videos and links and all of your work. And it'll be really fun. And now all of those people that said, Heather Day, Heather Day, Heather Day, they'll be so happy.
Yeah, it's gonna be so weird hearing my voice. But thanks again for this opportunity. It's been great.
Yeah, it was so fun. And next time I'm in San Francisco, I'll look you up.
Please do.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks.
Okay,
bye.
Bye. So good. I think we really did cover an insane amount of topics in that hour. After the fact, though, both of us kind of felt like maybe we talked about sponsorships and brand collaboration too much. But at the same time, I think it's really interesting and an important discussion, so I left it in. And I totally appreciate how open and honest Heather was walking that tightrope, and I think she walks it beautifully. The other thing I kept thinking about was intention, intuition, and reflection around color and material choices. Because we talked about that a little bit and about the list that I made in Venice, because I wanted to have a visual vocabulary around color. And I don't think I explained myself very well because I didn't just sit down and plan it. It was more of a, after years and years of working with certain colors, I did the reflecting in Venice and sat down and sort of thought about, well, when do I use those colors and why do I use those colors, and actually figured it all out. So exactly what Heather said, the reflection part of it often comes much, much after, not while you're in the moment. And I mean, who doesn't want to make a list while drinking coffee and eating gelato in Venice, right? It's a perfect list-making, reflecting kind of place. So that is what I did. And I just wanted to explain that a little better. I hope I did. Anywho, thank you so much to Heather for sharing all of her stories and, again, being so open and honest about everything. Thank you to Saatchi Art for supporting this episode. And, of course, thanks to you for listening. There will be more Art for Your Ear next weekend. See you then.